Hello everyone, welcome to the Hummels for Thought podcast. This is Joey speaking. So this episode was recorded on Saturday, December the 14th, just 2 days after the UK elections, which gave the Tories a resounding majority. This victory now threatens popular institutions like the NHS and has opened the door wider to xenophobic and far-right politics. Naturally, it has also made the prospect of a hard Brexit more likely, and possibly even a no deal. Whatever happens next, it is very clear that what is happening in the UK should be discussed, and I genuinely feel that our guest is best placed to do just that. Musa Okonga is a British writer currently based in Berlin. In addition to his work as a writer and podcaster discussing football, Musa has often written about such issues as race, being queer, and coming from a migrant background. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoy speaking with Musa, and I hope that you'll find it informative. Thank you.
Musa Okonga. I'm a writer and primarily write journalism about football, but also current affairs, a bit of politics. I make a bit of music and I co-host a football podcast called Stadio. I'm based in Berlin, London born, so I guess English, British English, Black English, or whatever you might call it. Parents are Ugandan, refugees from India, means Uganda. Been living in Berlin for the last 5 years, but keeping a close eye on British politics and English nationalism.
And I guess now we have got quite a good timing to speak about English nationalism, since we've had these elections that have, I think it's fair to say, shocked quite a lot of people. So I'll just give some numbers for our listeners to get a good picture. So nearly 60% of voters between 18 and 24 voted for Labour, while 18% of over 65s voted for the Tories. But in terms of the national numbers, obviously, in total the Tories got 364 seats, because they got a majority of the votes of the country, and Labour got 203 seats, while the SNP got 48, the Lib Dems 11, the DUP 8, and so on. In England, the results have been fairly disheartening, again, to put it quite mildly, and while in Scotland and Northern Ireland, we've been seeing fairly interesting developments, rather positively, I think, but maybe we can leave this aside for a sec. So, I guess my question to you would be if the results surprised you, and if yes or no, why?
The results didn't surprise me, and I say that because, you know, you can't fake surprise, right? So when I saw the results for, let's say, I mean, Brexit wasn't a surprise. I had a feeling of nausea, but I was expecting it. Trump's election, I predicted in February 2016. I really saw him winning, so his election again didn't surprise me, but I still feel a bit ill that he got elected. This result, I didn't go out in town to watch it because I was like, they're going to win. And they're going to win big, I guess. And yeah, it didn't surprise me at all, because what I was hearing back was that the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, unfortunately, for various reasons, was not very popular with the electorate. So you saw a huge fall-off in the Labour vote. There was a big drop-off in their vote. There wasn't actually that much of a growth in the Conservative vote, I think only by a small percentage. Mm-hmm. But the sustained, you know, Corbyn for sure made significant, I think, strategic mistakes. And also, I think people have to also understand the sheer firepower of the right-wing media. I mean, this is a formidable beast. And I don't think people fully appreciate what it does to the kind of terrain of the UK in terms of the public discourse. But also, I think people underestimate the fact that the UK has a very strong island mentality, has maybe always been one foot in, one foot out of the EU. And Boris Johnson, I think, exploited that Euroscepticism perfectly. So here we are. And there's no surprise to me.
And indeed, you wrote this article, what was it, like 10 days ago, on the so-called lopsided centre. And I have it in front of me. On basically, you examined essentially why there is this issue in the media, as you call it. And I completely agree with you that it has this very, very strong right-wing bias, I guess, if we want to be nice about it. There is definitely a structural inability to even see politicians like Boris Johnson as, I don't know if it's as human beings that are capable of lying and deceit and, you know, fear-mongering and all of that. And I guess, I don't know, can you talk to us a bit about this?
Well, yes, it's because I think there's this instant, this fear exists, Joey, because the fear exists because we're like, what, democracy isn't working, right? If you elect a leader of a country and you see that leader behaving in egregious fashion, we created all these democratic structures so that leaders like this would respect our norms, and when they don't, it's frightening. So the shutdown, the default position is therefore, we saw Donald Trump, oh, Donald Trump has become presidential. You know, we keep grasping at these straws to let us feel that people like Boris Johnson are not behaving in ways that are unbefitting of a leader, because we're so emotionally invested in order. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's like literally. Continue.
Does that make sense? The reason why we go soft on leaders in power across the world, whoever they are, whether they're Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, whoever, is because I think a lot of us want an easy life or a quieter life, right? And the idea that someone who we've elected, democratically elected, you know, in relatively fair elections or free and fair elections, is behaving in a way that is abhorrent, is frightening, because it makes us question the entire social order. So we're always looking for reasons why this person belongs to be in the office we've elected them to, because the implications that millions of people have elected a demagogue are too frightening. And that is why, in a lot of these authoritarian regimes, very early on, you know, the early stages of any authoritarian regime, you often see the disbelief of the middle class. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, they can't believe this demagogue is slaughtering people. There's all these rumors, oh, this person is like having that person abducted. In the early stages, you can't believe. You're like, no, that can't be happening. The middle class disbelief is such a dangerous force. And I think we're there now with the UK.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. You know, I moved to the UK in 2015 to do my studies, and I stayed for, well, until a few months ago. One of the earliest things I remember really shocking me was a day or two after the Brexit vote, and I've told the story a few times, but it's just relevant now again. I remember just being in the tube in London, and there was this, you know, elderly man in his 60s, I would guess, and he was reading, I think it was either the Daily Mail or the Sun, one of the two. And I just remember seeing on this, the headline was something like, you know, it was one of those anti-migrant headlines. So you had the random brown face, some guy, might be Iraqi, Syrian, Afghani, I don't know. You know, it's one of those stories where basically saying that these people are coming to invade us, these people are coming to invade us. And it's one of those headlines that obviously we saw before Brexit as well, that was, I suppose for you as well, the reason why it wasn't really that surprising. Definitely shocking nonetheless.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but not really shocking. Not surprising in the sense that this makes zero sense to us. Like, this doesn't make any sense. It does make sense in its own way because, well, if that's the media system, if that's the media scape, if these are the terms that are being debated here, where people can be dehumanized so quickly, where they can just be reduced in, you know, into faceless, nameless groups of hordes of foreigners or whatever, it's not that difficult to see how someone like Boris Johnson can get into power, really.
No, exactly, because he's traveling along a path that's been well laid for him.
Yeah.
And this is the thing as well, I think there's something to be said for reclaiming phrases, framing. So I've just finished writing a piece, which is hopefully going up soon in a different publication, about Britishness, Englishness. And what seems to be happening is there's this constant need to be reducing Britishness and taking away from those people who previously claimed it. So British Muslims are not British anymore. That's a new development. Before you could be British and something else, right? But now, if you're Muslim, you're not British. This is what I'm seeing now on social media, from Katie Hopkins, who has, I think, over 1 million followers on Twitter, who someone told me to ignore, but I'm like, how can you ignore someone with 1 million followers on Twitter?
Yeah.
How can you ignore a far-right voice with 1 million followers on Twitter? So in response to that, actually, Joey, my response is to say, actually, I'm not British, I'm also English. I'm English. Because if you're telling me, because before I think as an immigrant, I would say I'm a proud immigrant, and I am, but I would also not claim the titles that I was not allowed to claim, right? So I'd say, yeah, I'm a proud immigrant, but I wouldn't say I'm a proud Englishman, because that was never allowed to me. But now I'm thinking, no, I reject that framing. Now I'm a proud immigrant and I'm a proud Englishman. I'm going to start saying, I've never said that before, but actually it feels important, as identity is being stolen from us, to say, actually, I'm a citizen of the world, and that involves being a citizen of the United Kingdom, and that involves specifically being an Englishman as well. Because I think it's important to plant our feet in places where we're not supposed to plant them.
And obviously,
that feels to me really important at this point.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see where you're coming from. And I think obviously this speaks to this the threat of especially English nationalism. And I think one of the most surprising quotes that I've read recently was this the former leader of the Ulster Unionist Party saying, and I quote, "The great irony of all of this is that for decades unionists have looked over their shoulders and decided that Irish nationalists were the great threat, but actually it's English nationalism." And we saw obviously in Northern Ireland for the first time, I don't know if it's ever, but definitely in a long time, a majority of nationalist MPs, as in Irish nationalist MPs, were elected, nine MPs compared to eight pro-UK MPs, all DUP. It's definitely a very, very strange moment that we're going through, and it certainly feels like it's uncharted territory.
I mean, yes, can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
It feels uncharted only because climate change is a grand game changer. In fact, there are two grand game changers here. We have authoritarian surveillance capitalism on a scale we've never seen before. That is, we've had authoritarian capitalism before, and we've had surveillance capitalism, but this electronic element is something that is a game changer. We have the far right, the global far right is well networked. And what we also have, unfortunately, is we have the existential threat of climate change. And this is the worst possible time in human history to be erecting borders. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's happening. If I'm going to be completely cynical, Joey, I think there's a lot of people with a lot of money who are thinking, if there's going to be this huge migration from India and from Africa, as climate change worsens, as fresh water runs out in India, and you know, by 2030, they say a huge percentage of India will not have access to fresh water. That's within the next, 11 years, right? Within 40% of India may not have fresh water. If I'm a wealthy person who believes in the great replacement theory, the fear that we're going to be overrun in the West by non-white people, what is the most powerful thing I could do? If I destroy the EU, all of a sudden I put dozens of borders between myself and those countries. That is what I think the end game is to a lot of this. That sounds super cynical, but I think people are expecting huge levels of climate migration. They do believe in climate change, they're not deniers. And what we're going to see in the next 15, 20 years is eco-fascism in its purest form. Defend our natural environment, defend our nation, our Western European nations, white nations, by shutting out desperate, fleeing black and brown people. That is super cynical, Joey, but that's how I've seen it for a long time.
I mean, one of the things that we've been seeing in the past few years is the move by quite a significant number of billionaires and decamillionaires to, for example, buy land in New Zealand and in some of these countries that allow these kind of purchases, because they actually firmly believe that essentially Armageddon is coming, that, you know, the dystopian future is upon us, and they are acting upon this belief. They're acting as though this is something that can happen. And while most of these billionaires, and, you know, most of them being men, most of these men may not take these steps, it does seem to me, in my opinion, and I completely agree with you, echoing what you just said, that there seems to be, at least on a subconscious level, this fear. And the paranoia over this, as you called it, the great replacement theory, the great replacement fear and everything, is something that is definitely expressed, or at least those with power are the ones who can act upon this fear. But it certainly feels to me that there is a widespread fear, even among the middle class and working classes in many countries, yes. Especially those in the West, obviously. Yes. And it goes back to this, I forgot the name of the historian, but you shared him yesterday or today, who mentions that one of the problems within social democratic governments, like the Labour Party historically, was essentially to, if not say so directly, but at least imply through actions, that the great welfare state is something that is quote-unquote ours, that it's something that we possess. And yes. If there isn't us, then there has to be a them.
Yes. This is, you know, it's Professor David Andress of the University of Portsmouth, I believe.
Yeah.
Who is an excellent follow on Twitter, by the way. And he tweeted, yeah, the great sin, the great original sin of the health service was precisely that it was for white English people.
Mm-hmm.
And George Orwell, I think he quoted George Orwell, a brilliant quote where he was saying, you know, unfortunately, this welfare state was paid for by imperial gains, and as those gains fall away, then we're going to have a reckoning. And we haven't had that reckoning. I had a conversation with a friend just today about the fact that the British sort of white working class, well, specifically the English white working class, specifically, have not had the conversation about empire. And if you think about it, if you're poor white working class and everyone's saying you're privileged because you've benefited from empire, but you yourself are living in a place which is impoverished, you will ask, well, where are these gains that I've got? Which is a strange position, because you're kind of just saying all these things we're supposed to have stolen, how have I benefited? Which is not really a thing you want to be saying about a bank robbery, right? Like, it's a global bank robbery, the empire. So you can't really go and say, why haven't I gained from this robbery? But you're also inclined to ask, well, who has taken it then? And people in desperate situations, and this is what Boris Johnson has exploited so well, people in desperate circumstances rarely look upwards. They rarely look upwards and go, look at all the tax being stolen from under my nose and taken offshore. And what Boris Johnson, I think, has realised, to a certain extent, this is not the only reason the Conservatives won, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's the only reason they won, but I think a major reason they won, is that Boris Johnson understands the value of English nationalism. He understands the value of, we will not be bullied by that foreign power, being the EU in this case, which is untrue, but anyway. That's such a powerful rallying force. Such a powerful rallying force, and Boris Johnson understood that intimately, and that's why they won. Well, partly anyway.
Yeah, there's this fascinating long read that I think it's also in audio format, and I've listened to it like two or three times now, called The Paranoid Fantasy Behind Brexit by Fintan O'Toole. And
he's amazing. He's amazing. Yeah, he's brilliant.
It's such a good article, and I will link it in the show notes. But like, the general argument and the general thesis of the piece is that there is actually a need for English nationalists to feel like they are the victims. Like, there is an actual, one of the quotes here is that the worst thing to have happened to English nationalism is winning the Second World War. Because then you no longer have this, obviously, the Nazi threat.
Well, actually, a defining aspect of empire is self-pity.
Yes.
You know, they shouldn't call it white supremacy. They should call it white self-pity. Yeah. Because that's what it is. Like, that's what it is. It's not... supremacy, I understand why the phrase is used that way, and I think it's a great phrase in academic terms, but to me, it's always meant a fear of competing on level terms.
Mm.
The second, you have to compete on level terms. I mean, you imagine like generations of slave owners, right?
Yeah.
All they have to subjugate the population working in fields, fundamentally, is force, fear, guns. It's not respect. Imagine growing up for generations in a household knowing that you own human beings whose humanity you try to deny, but you cannot deny because you're allowed to raise your children, right? So you're raising, you're basically like owning human beings whose dignity you cannot deny. You're watching them year by year get stronger in the fields, develop literacy in their kids, against the odds, keep their sense of dignity. That is a terrifying thing. That is a terrifying thing to watch. And what that does to the psyche of the period of generations, I just cannot imagine, because I'm not white, I'm not from that, you know, that framework. But I think that this stuff is all relevant. And, you know, I think that this whole culture of, I think it's why it's so hard for a lot of people to set aside national pride. Because if you start unpicking what it actually is, like if you actually say to people, okay, the British Empire, you do realise people castrated the pliers. You do realise people's resources were stolen. You do realise people were beaten to death, were drowned, were this and that, were raped, were tortured. If you ask somebody, are you proud of that? They're going to tell you, no, of course, how can I be proud of that? How can I be proud? I thought it was all parades and, you know, and great art and naval trading. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
People have been sold such a lie. And imagine you've been told, it's like, it sounds like a stupid example, but you know, like all these, like, you have a favourite childhood show, like the Cosby Show, you find out Cosby, Bill Cosby's been doing this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Bill Cosby's actually, imagine that, but not for one TV show, but for huge aspects of your entire upbringing for generations back.
Yeah.
And like, imagine the scale, like, every institution that you revere is drenched in blood. That is overwhelming. It's overwhelming.
Fintan O'Toole called it, or at least one of the sentences in his essay, the ironic reversal of zombie imperialism. And he called it essentially the appropriation of the imagery of resistance to a former colonizing power, i.e. the romance of martyrdom is mobilized as defiance of the EU, and basically saying that the EU has been turned into this massive other where you can really like project almost anything on it. The EU, you know, one of the infamous bus of that Nigel Farage was in front of during the Brexit referendum of supposedly Turkey is going to join now and everyone's going to come, and Turkey is the, you know, the connection to the Middle East, which implies that Syrians and Afghanis and, you know, Iraqis are all going to be at your doorstep tomorrow. And it really speaks to, as you said, a deep-seated fear that is simply not being addressed and may even be super difficult to address. But if we don't start somewhere, how will we still be surprised that, that someone like Boris Johnson, who is so openly narcissistic and misogynistic and racist and Islamophobic and pretty much everything that's bad, can still get a majority of votes?
There's a good friend of mine living in LA right now, and she will tell you that I called this 10 years ago. I called his election 10 years ago. She will tell you, like, I've been talking about it for 10 years. I could see it. And that's because another defining instinct, element of empire is not self-pity, it's projection. As you said perfectly, it's projection. And I love that you mentioned that word, because this is what gets us here. If you look at like a lot of the British foundational myths, right, they're not actually about British people. Like the most popular songs we have, God Save the Queen, right, Rule Britannia, these are not about the English people, they're about ideals of what we imagine ourselves to be, the idea of the monarchy, the projection. Rule Britannia, that lyric goes, Britain never shall be slaves. This is written at the height of slave trading.
Yeah.
And what is that saying? A saying, even though there's almost a sort of acknowledgement there that what they're doing is wrong. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right there in the middle of a hymn, in the middle of one of the proudest British hymns, you have the self-loathing, you have the denial, or the denial, and the self, there's a very particular form of self-loathing that manifests as denial, right?
Yeah.
And you see it in Rule Britannia with that lyric, Britain never ever shall be slaves. if being an empire is so glorious, then why is it so awful to be a product of it? Why is it so awful to be something which is a natural result of empire, to be an enslaved person? Because you know what you're doing is terrible, and you're afraid that one day it will be done to you. And the thought, you know, this thing about the kind of, you know, the EU bullying us, even though I think the UK ran over 99, the UK basically got 99% of the laws it wanted passed through the EU. And almost 70% of those laws, I think over 70% of those laws were passed without revision to the draft. As a friend of mine said, the UK dominated the EU. Dominated it. Which actually is interesting colonial language. And it's probably quite a good reason, if you're anti-colonial, you might say actually it's good for the UK leave, because you shouldn't have a country like that enjoying power like that. There's other arguments there, but I don't want to get into them because I think they're slightly separate. But yeah, self-pity and projection, and I think that Boris Johnson embodies all of that.
Both Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, and I'm assuming a number of other Tories, have actually utilized anti-colonial language to describe themselves. They've actually said things like, Britain is turning into a colony of the Europeans. Yes. There, which is, yeah, it's, I mean, in addition to really adding insult to injury on victims to victims of colonialism and imperialism, it really does show in as clearest terms possible how this projection actually works. It's like they are telling us what they know on subconscious level, maybe, what the crimes were.
Exactly. Yes, they're telling us, and to be honest, if we just left a podcast, if we just had a recorder under the nose, we'd get an entire podcast of colonial crimes. Because they're clearly, it's almost like they're making a confession to us. You know, the thing is, they're doing this stuff in plain sight. The thing that, you know, combines and connects Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson, is the feeling they can't quite imagine they're getting away with this. They can't believe that they're being allowed to get away with it. Nigel Farage comes to Berlin, gets a standing ovation from the far-right AfD party, and has one of the biggest radio shows in the UK on LBC Radio. Mm-hmm. What that tells you is, and this is what I say to myself now, if I'm in the same room debating with someone who I think to be a clown, then I'm in the wrong room, Joey. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it means that whoever has put a clown out to bid against me is watching behind a glass screen laughing and going, look how I've wasted this person's time. This is why I stopped doing these debates on TV with these English nationalists, because I realised these people are just proxies. My time is far better to spend trying to deconstruct the systems that produce these proxies. And that's why I call the system an algorithm, right? Because I call it an algorithm, it's a system, but I call them algorithms now. Why? Because they produce products that all look the same. Look at them. Trump, Bolsonaro, Duterte, they all look the same. They're all these loud, blustering strongmen. They've been created by intense inequality, economic inequality, money laundering across borders, you know, brutality both of a kind of verbal and physical variety. They are all the same. And narcissism, they're all the narcissism. So I think it's interesting, it's more important, a better use of my time, and this is why I'm doing this podcast with you, not only because I really respect your work, all those listeners, Joey's work, Joey's Twitter account is one of my favourite on Twitter, and I learned so much from it, so thank you, Joey.
Thanks.
My time is far better spent deconstructing these structures and breaking down what's at the root of them. You know, not who is Boris Johnson, but what is Boris Johnson as a phenomenon? Why did he arise? And where from, and if we know all that, then we can start to dismantle.
Yeah, and it almost doesn't matter who Boris Johnson is, because he is more than happy to put on as many masks as this the situation demands it. And
exactly.
I would admit that while I was not expecting a Labour win for all of the reasons that we mentioned, whether the mistakes that Labour itself has made, the mistakes made by either Corbyn personally or the party as a whole, or just, as you mentioned as well, the sheer intensity of the right-wing bend to the UK media system, Mediascape. I do admit that I was slightly surprised by the majority of that the Conservatives managed to get. At the same time, I'm trying to wonder, and here I'm just thinking out loud, really, if there is a way for Scottish nationalists to sort of use the term nationalist without really meaning nationalist in the same way as the English do when they use the word nationalist. Mm. Is there a way for those English, such as yourself, who obviously have very good reasons to fear English nationalism, is there a way for them to sort of reclaim it while being careful to not enable its much worse manifestations, if that makes sense?
Yes, and I think the way I look at it is, I mean, I think all nationalism is a problem. So I never, for example, I would never use nationalism or populism as tools, mm-hmm. because I think the exceptionalism is dangerous. I think what I would look at is trying to look at a sense of English identity and talk about inclusivity, because if you look at, and it sounds ridiculous, but if you look at like the youth movements by people like Akala and Stormzy, like, you know, British rappers, if you look at their concerts and the stuff they talk about, the inclusivity of their fan bases, that to me is far more useful. If you look at the England football team, for example, or the cricket team, you don't have those teams or those people going, we're better than other nations. We're like, oh look, here's a thing we happen to do. Here's a land that we all were born in, mm-hmm. or have moved to quite an early age, and we've therefore adopted it as our own. And there's a fluidity there, but for the time we're here, we contribute to it in the same way that I'm living in Germany now. I've been in my area for 5 years, and I feel very much part of this area, and I contribute to it. I do free writing clinics, I help out where I can, I volunteer where I can, you know, I go on protests where I can. Like, I'm a part of the area. I'm paying my fees here, my taxes here, whatever, like, and I'm proud of that, right? And I think this is the key, to move towards a place where whatever identity you assume for a period of time, inhabit it fully and do it with compassion, right? And that's what I'm trying to sort of say, that I'm not going to allow people to say that's my Englishness anymore or that's my Britishness anymore. No, this is also mine. You cannot exclude me. If you put a yellow star on me, or whatever, a pink star in my case, you put a pink star on me and go, oh, you're queer, there's a pink star, I can claim the pink star, go, yeah, it's a pink star, it's still a pink star. I'm still accepting that frame of engagement, right? So even English nationalism, I wouldn't say I was an English nationalist, not at all, actually. I would say, and I think that actually, to be honest, I think Scottish nationalists, they may have challenges down the line, mm-hmm. with just the word nationalism. I'm not even judging them as a, I'm not judging them at all, I'm just saying the word itself is like the word populism. Unfortunately, there's some things that's actually quite difficult to reclaim. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, independence, by all means, and call it independence, whatever, but I just think that word is, there are some things I think are beyond redemption. Unfortunately, I think that word, it's a word that has too many troubling connotations for me personally. I'm not knocking anyone who uses it in the Scottish context, I'm just saying for me personally, I have issues mm-hmm. with it. I think it doesn't work for me.
I totally agree with that. And I think, for those who don't know, I actually watched I attended a talk in which, that was attended by Nicola Sturgeon, the Prime Minister, the First Minister of Scotland. And she was asked about this specific question, like, do you identify as a nationalist? And you can see that there is an uncomfortable understanding, because she's not stupid. She's fairly smart, actually. And I think that she knows the connotations of that term. And she basically said that if she could go back in time, she would change the name of the SNP to something else. And Mary Black, you know, the youngest SNP MP who was elected to Parliament, also said basically the same thing. She actually said that she's only an SNP member because she supports independence. And as soon as independence is granted, her loyalty is up for grabs, basically, in terms of party loyalty, which I found quite interesting as well. But I definitely...
Oh my God, what a great signing she would be for any other party, my goodness.
Yes.
Oh my God.
I think there's something to be said about the youth component. Maybe not over generalizing too much about these generational changes, but it does seem to me that those who are, many anyway, those who are in their teens and early 20s have a sort of different... I don't know if I would say different consciousness necessarily, but definitely a different set of priorities than many of the rest of us, to be honest.
Actually, I would say a different consciousness. Mm-hmm. I would actually, weirdly enough. And one thing I haven't given enough praise to, and I want to just say, whoever listens to this, can I just give my wholehearted praise to the Momentum volunteers who went out mm-hmm. and canvassed day after day, week after week, in many cases, who went out and did huge amounts of work. Now, I know that there were challenges with the campaign, but I just want to give my respect to them because that's not easy. I only ever canvassed for a couple of afternoons, so I haven't done it for much myself. And I know door knocking can be draining work, and that's just a couple of days of doing it. For those who did it for like days on end, for weeks, it's extraordinary. And these people are fighting for their lives as well. These are people growing up, the 80-24 bracket, they're growing up with the existential challenge of climate change. They've got their whole lives ahead of them, right? I'm 40. So I've lived about half my life. So we owe it to these younger people, not just to acknowledge their work, but to provide the platforms upon which they can build a better world, because they're also making those platforms. And one thing I want to say as well, because I'm seeing a lot of critique already of what Labour did wrong, and I'm very worried that when you write these critiques, and I'm writing one at the moment, I'm very worried people write critiques who are a bit older and haven't been out in the field doing this work. Younger people feel alienated and discouraged. And they feel like, oh my God, like we're just being dumped on. We did all this hard work and we've got a landslide against us. And what I'm trying to argue in this article, my wife at the moment, is just say, listen, like, full respect to you. It's just very hard, no matter who the leader is, it's very hard to win an election as a Labour Party in Britain. It's just very hard. We've had three different types of loser. We've had Gordon Brown, right? We've had Ed Miliband, we had Jeremy Corbyn. These are three very different, well, all men, but, you know, three very different types of leader. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And they've all tried to win elections in different ways. And they've all been in their own way. They've all had very praiseworthy aspects of their platforms, all of them, in my opinion. All of them. Even Ed Miliband, who, frankly, economically wasn't hardcore enough and signed on to a lot of austerity, but, you know, still, there were, like, praiseworthy elements. These would all have been, in my opinion, far better leaders than the crop we've seen. And what concerns me, I think, is that young people are pushed away, and I don't want them to be discouraged. I know that some of them will be inevitably. I think there's no point to it. But what I will say is, look, unfortunately, we're at a period in history. You know those social justice movements? Like, we're back where they were, the civil rights movement or some of the suffragettes might have been. You know those periods in history where people worked and they were like, we may not see change in our lifetime that's positive?
Yeah.
I think we're in that phase again in some respects. And there's no shame in that. There's no shame because we cannot choose the point of history we're in. The trick is to identify that point of history, to identify actually we are at the beginning of the turning of the tide. We may not get to see a turn, but what we do now is even more important. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying stubbornness, but I'm saying principle is more important than ever, Joey. We have to stick to our guns now, because we're almost paying it forward, if that makes sense.
It does.
Do you watch those Marvel movies? I don't know if you watch them at all. Do you watch them?
I do.
Okay, so you know that moment in like when Doctor Strange basically gives the stone to Thanos and says it was the only way.
Yeah.
And they get wiped. Yeah, and they get wiped out. Like half of them get wiped out. And it's only by accepting defeat then, or getting a landslide against them. So we've kind of had our Thanos moment now, right?
Yeah.
It's only by having our Thanos moment that we can begin to rebuild from scratch. And look how devastated they were in the first half hour of like the Endgame movie. They were utterly broken. We're in the first 20 minutes of the Endgame movie right now. And we're just rebuilding, and no one has got any desire to do anything. And this is the point at which we go, okay, now we build something.
Yeah, I think this speaks to the point that Gary Young also made, that, you know, it's true that now is a moment to, you know, that I'm quoting here, the left must now find the space to grieve and think simultaneously. So it's not that feeling down or, you know, defeated or anything like that is unnatural and we should be ashamed of it. Not at all. It's just that, as he said, and again, I'm quoting him, this is not about us. This is about a more hopeful society we want to create, the people we want to create it with, and the dystopia that the Tories are in the process of creating. So it's sort of like in just this sentence, he was at the same time So he managed to put forward what this thing that we want to create is. So a more hopeful society. The fact, he also pointed out the fact that obviously we need our fellow travelers, you know, partners in the struggle and so on. So the people we want to create it with. And at the same time, the thing that we're fighting against, which in this case is this dystopia that the Tories, as he said, are in the process of creating. And then he says, and we won't be in this position, or we won't be in a position again to in a position to win again until we work out why we lost. And that's definitely going to be the most difficult aspect of this. I would urge everyone not to necessarily interpret the mood of a whole country, or indeed a whole world, based on what they see on Twitter, because if the past 20 or so, or 40 hours or so, or any, if we just get them from Twitter, it's pretty depressing and people are eating themselves alive and all of that. And I think that we should really remember that most of the struggle is not going to happen on social media. It's going to happen face to face, and we will have to confront people with whom we will definitely have strong disagreements, but with whom I think, I genuinely believe that most people agree on the basics. That most people agree on a common humanity, to put it simply. It's just that how this is expressed is the difficult part, and how the challenges ahead of us essentially is how do we find a common language that people can understand, that unifies people without at the same time throwing anyone under the bus.
Do you know what scares me though, Joey?
Yeah.
I'm slightly fearful. I think we do have a common humanity. But I think that when it comes down to it, in times of severe economic inequality, people vote for self-preservation.
Yeah.
And so people are voting to protect what they already have. So you're voting to keep out newcomers who might come in, because a lot of these people have seen immigrants come in, have great lives, earn loads of money, send money back to Poland, and disappear back to Poland, back to Bulgaria, or that's what they've seen. Right? That's what they, that's how they perceive these things. Right? They perceive people are living better than they are. They're coming in and coming out, taking the money and going out again, right?
Yeah.
And my fear is not the common humanity aspect. My fear is that people are squeezed, and when they're squeezed, they're like, it's very hard to believe in the collective good of society when you feel that you have nothing, or you have nothing, and it's, you don't see where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So a major reason for the vote against the EU, not the only reason, but a major reason was, why are we spending all this money on the EU when we like don't have public services here?
Yeah.
Right, which is a critique of the government. So my fear is actually, this is the thing that really worries me. We can go door to door and have these conversations, right? We have to reassure people to come out from traumatized states where they're like, this Conservative Party is the devil we know. You're offering plans you can't afford. You're going to plunge us even further into debt, because the way that the national conversation has gone is that the Conservative Party basically said Labour can't afford that.
Mm.
Now, you go to a poor household and you say, we're offering you even more debt, they're going to slam the door in your face.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to the manifesto. People are like, you can't afford this. You can't afford this free broadband. This is what we should be doing, actually. And I've got several proposals for what we could do, or suggestions what we could do. They need to start linking the deprivation of these areas to tax that has been stolen by multinational companies.
Mm.
Stolen. Like, that should be a primary proposal. Like, one of the first things out the gate should have been like, and it was part of it, I'm not going to get, but it didn't really cut through as far as I can see, should have been, this money is yours. Like, it's not like we're going to raise taxes. The money is already there. We don't need to raise a penny in tax, actually. We need to get the money back from offshore. It's been stolen. Like, imagine there's like a bank account, you go there and there's no money in it. You're like, oh, who's stolen the money? Oh, that person wrote a huge house. Only the huge house is a multinational company in the middle of an ocean somewhere. That person has stolen your money. That company has stolen your money. That needs to be the framework, because that's actually true. I didn't see enough of that conversation.
Yeah.
And I was watching a lot of the election coverage. I didn't really see enough of that. Does that make sense, Joey?
It does, yeah, yeah.
I didn't hear enough of that. And like, that's actually a radical step which people would get behind. And I think that works on a doorstep a lot more, right? And I'm not saying people didn't use that argument. I'm saying it didn't cut through, because I didn't see it cut through.
Yeah.
And I was watching a lot of this coverage. So we need to stop there. The other thing that needs to happen as well, Jerry, this is really important. I think Labour needs to jump on the next Eurostar and go and meet politicians and civil society organisations across Europe, because it's not doing enough of that at the moment. There aren't enough Labour politicians and activists from the UK coming from. I know a lot of them are busy, I'm not judging all of them, people are busy and it's money, it's difficult. But, and also that Europe needs to make more of an effort, more than ever, needs to go two ways. Civil society organisations who are progressive in the UK, in Europe and beyond, need to form better alliances. They need to have like each other on WhatsApp, on Telegram, whatever, because that coordination is not happening. It's definitely happening with the far right. I was talking to a guy here a few months ago, and he was saying how he lived in the same area as some Nazis, and the Nazis were openly talking, even back in the 90s, oh yeah, we've just been in the UK, we've been networking. The Nazis have been building alliances with the UK for like 20 years.
Yeah.
And we know this has been happening, right? But like, the left needs to do that. The left needs to build its alliances. Because also what this does, Joey, is this then improves the foreign policy. Because one criticism I do have the Labour Party, which is quite strong, is that unfortunately their foreign policy did look along, unfortunately, kind of like default English nationalist lines,
yeah,
in a weird kind of way, like this anti-imperial policy. So Labour's policy on Syria through Emily Thornberry was very, very, very dodgy.
Yeah.
Very dodgy indeed. And if you build, if you look for the kind of Syrian left, then you don't make things easy, you don't make these obvious mistakes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Find the Syrian left, find the Palestinian left, and your problems with anti-Semitism, this shit evaporates pretty fast. It might, call me naive, but I think these problems actually go away pretty quick.
Yeah.
If you make the right alliances. And I sound like, if you've got, pardon my Spanish, I don't want to swear on your podcast because different listeners, but call me naive and idealistic, but I've been sitting here just thinking, this is now an opportunity to get this stuff right. Anyway, yeah.
I completely agree with that. I think that that's a very, very good point to end on, actually. Is there anything that you feel that we should have talked about but didn't?
No, I just want to, again, recommend Joey's Twitter because it's brilliant. And, yeah, you can find me on Twitter. My surname is at Okwonga. But, yeah, Joey, I just want to say to your listeners, thank you for listening to what I have to say. Obviously, get in touch with your comments, critiques. I'm always happy to hear. And Joey, yourself, you've got the great work. Yeah, complete respect for what you're doing. It's just an honour to speak to you. Real privilege.
Likewise. And I will link...